This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Alison Swaim spent a year at sea. She rode on 8 different cargo ships circumnavigating the world. Her goal? To document life on the ship. Who are these sailors, and how do goods, gasoline and food and all the trinkets we buy from around the world, how do they get to us? She came back a year ago with hours of tape and hundreds of photos from her time on cargo ships. Now there's a show at the Carrick Modern Art in Durham. A group of artists in the community worked with Alison, studied her material, and made their own art in response to her journey. The show, Hold Capacity, Trade Route Stories Reimagined, closes on Saturday. Going to be a performance of the work this Friday, August 9th at 8 o'clock. Alison Swaim joins us now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So what made you want to get on cargo ships and go around the world?
Well, to make it short, I had an opportunity to apply for a Watson Fellowship soon after I finished college at Oberlin up in Ohio, and I was interested in trade and the global economy and how goods are moving around the world, and I read on Wikipedia that mostly it's by ship. 90% of everything that is carried and transported and shipped is carried on a ship, and I hadn't known that before, and I became obsessed and fascinated. Why don't I know more about this, and why don't I see ships, you know? So
it is kind of amazing, all the stuff out of view, 90%, and that means probably 90% of the stuff we have, because most of it does come from abroad, and therefore it's all been on a boat, right?
Right, and it's not just what you buy at Walmart, sorry to cut you off, but it's also like everything that was used to construct this building, you know, the gas that's going into our cars, raw material.
Yeah. And so all of that happens. Now, how did you get on board? Were you a crew member? Did you go on board as a documentarian? How did it happen?
Yeah, so I was on board. I wanted to be very transparent about what I was there for. I have a camera. I have a microphone. I have a lot of gear. I'm here to gather stories of people who work on board with their consent. It was not easy to get access. So I spent a year traveling. About half the year, I was at different ports, kind of docked, waiting for to work out the next logistics. And the only way that it was really possible was I joined a group for women in the shipping industry called Women's International Shipping and Trading Association. Jeannie Grasso here in U.S. is the U.S. coordinator. But they really helped me understand the shipping community on land. There are a ton of people involved, not just on the ship, but the ship's at the end of this long chain. So you got the ship owner, the ship operator, the agent, the broker, the blah, you know what I mean? All these people, it's complex. And I had to understand how that worked in order to figure out who to go to get access. So,
and you were talking to everybody on the ship. I think one of the interesting things is the hierarchy on a ship, very hierarchical. And so give us a sense of what it's like, because it's a small community. So you think everybody's talking to everybody else, but no.
Right. These ships are huge, but you generally have about 20 to 25 people on board these days, which is a big change over the last couple of decades. But yeah, I kind of had this really amazing access where the captain would talk to me frankly about things, and then I would talk to the deck cadet, the lowest paid guy on the ship, and it's interesting to see the trickle of information down from the top to the bottom and how long it takes. And I was
they literally can't talk to each other. Like the cadet cannot talk to the captain.
Well,
just,
you know,
doesn't.
I mean, it just depends. Like, let's say you kind of have work divided into two main types. There are the folks who are in charge of navigation. They're up top and they're on deck working. And then you have the guys on the bottom in the engine room keeping all these machines running. So the oiler, the like low-ranking guy who cleans the machines, usually doesn't have any reason to talk to the captain.
And the captain sure doesn't want to get down in that engine room, so they're probably not going to chat unless they run into each other in the men's room.
Well, it's just
the head, I believe they call it. I don't know if they still do that.
Well, it's really just kind of like everybody knows their place and has a job, and that's how it works.
Well, listen, you talk to a lot of people, but we're going to hear from a cadet named, I think, Mariusz, who is a 19-year-old engine cadet from Poland, and he's giving you the lowdown on what it's like to be on that boat.
Actually, it's just like in prison, locked in one place, just can't do nothing. Yesterday, I read an article about Norway prison, where the prisoners can just go to the forest, go fishing, have internet access. That's just crazy for me. I can't use internet, I can't go to the forest, I can't fish, go fishing, because we're still moving, I can just watch the movie, go get drunk, smoke, and work.
There you go. Can't even troll, huh? Mariusz is a 19-year-old engine cadet, and he was someone who spoke with my guest, Allison Swaim, who did has got an art exhibit that is a collaboration of artists at the Carrick Modern in Durham. So why is he there? Doesn't sound that great.
Well, the ticket is it's good money. And a lot of the folks who work on ship these days, it's the much better opportunity to make a living than they would have in their home country. You got 60% of sailors out at sea and are from the Philippines. The Philippines is a very small country. It does not contain 60% of the world's population. So why are all these guys Filipino? It's because in the Philippines, it's hard to support a family. My friend Mark is a fourth engineer. He has an engineering degree. Okay, he has like a four-year degree as an engineer. That's good education. He's making 10 times what he would make at home in the Philippines on a ship, which means that he sees his three-month-old son, you know, a couple months out of a year. The next time he sees him, he's going to be like twice as big. You know, it's a sacrifice, but it's because he wants to support his family.
Therein lies a tale as well. So he's making good money for the Philippines. On the other hand, he's probably working cheap, and that's one of the advantages of having people from all over the world, the global economy, if you're a ship owner, right?
Right, and it can be pretty complex. Just with one ship, maybe the owner is in Norway, a big shipping country for years. And maybe the operator, the guys who are actually telling the ship where to go, are in Singapore. Singapore is a big shipping headquarters. Maybe the crew's from the Philippines, the rankings, and maybe the officers are from Romania, let's say, because Romanians are cheaper than Norwegians, a lot cheaper. But the Filipinos are pay even less salary. I don't know. It's just, yeah, it's real complex, and it's nothing, it's all very, nothing's hidden. I mean, global economic disparity is very transparent. When on the same ship, you have the guy from Poland making three times as much as the guy from the Philippines.
And they know this.
Yeah, they know this. On the one hand, it's like, how is that fair? I mean, how is that fair? But how is it fair that in the Philippines, life is harder than it is in the U.S.? That's not fair. Right. But I don't know. So.
And how is it possible? I guess you show your passport and then they pull out that nationality and there's your pay grade, huh?
Well, yeah. So, they have their crewing agency based in the Philippines. And the company will say, hey, we're going to try to recruit Chinese this year. Chinese are cheaper. So let's set up a school in China and send our reps there. We've heard the Chinese are getting better. I mean, it's real interesting hearing the way the shipping industry folks talk about nationality. And it's not, I mean, it's just, it's, people are tend to be a little bit different depending on where they're from, because that shapes how we are. So it's interesting, even the way that crew from Asian countries like might deal with an engine problem, they might all kind of put their heads together and work on it. Whereas if they're Greeks, maybe like the head engineer is going to take care of it and tell everybody else to go away. So it's the ship companies are choosing their crew based on these.
They're profiling.
I don't know. It's just, it's really interesting. It was a really interesting way for me to get a lens on global economic relations and, a lot of things.
Well,
like
that is interesting, but does it scale up? I mean, is there anything you can tell about those relations, the economic, the mm-hmm. pay relations, as well as the various cultural approaches to problem solving, all of that? Does it scale up, and can you tell anything about the global economy from what happens on a ship? Or are they two different universes?
Well, let's take 2008 global economic crisis. Everything crashed. Well, you have hundreds of ships sitting outside of Singapore at anchor because they're not enough. They don't need as many ships to move cargo. So,
yeah. So they're all certainly interleaved. And then the whole idea that because of this complex network of ownership, you have the ship owner, the seller, the person who's got the stuff, the cargo owner who then needs a seller at the other end. And at one point, that meant for you a ship that because there was some conflict with the buyer at the other end, the ship just sort of stayed out to sea.
You're talking about Corsaro when we ran out of food. Yeah.
Yeah, well, tell us the story.
Well, So the ship is kind of at the long end of this global chain of interactions to make a business transaction. So you have at one end the cargo seller and the other end the buyer. And you have so many people in the middle, I can't even count them. And usually it all runs smoothly. And the point and the goal of the ship is to move the cargo from point A to point B as quickly as possible. That's how they make their money. But occasionally something happens where things go off or there's a problem and that kind of gets broken down. So that happened. I was on a tanker in the Mediterranean. A tanker is, in this case, was transporting triple jet one fuel. So fuel for gas for jets. And I don't know exactly what happened to begin with, but I think at first the company hadn't decided who to sell the cargo to, So they were kind of stuck between choosing the buyer with the highest price. And so that's the first time we stopped in the middle of the ocean, kind of waiting for the orders about where to go. And then once they set the destination, so we cut the engine off, and then we finally got to the port. And then the cargo buyer rejected the cargo because it had some contamination of biodiesel in a small quantity. I don't know why, but a voyage that should have taken 4 days ended up taking about 3 weeks. And in the meantime, we started to run low on provisions. So
I can imagine. And so you talked to one of the crew members.
The question is, what's for lunch? Fried rice.
The cook doesn't have any more to cook.
Food. Craving for food.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're not supposed to be out there that long, and you're stopped. You don't go and dock somewhere and resupply. You're just in the middle of the water.
Right, I want to say this doesn't happen all the time. It's not, and it just was a kind of an unusual situation because we were also had been scheduled to take on provisions and more food at the very next port. It just turned out to be a lot longer than they'd expected.
Many women involved in this? And what was it like for you to be a woman on board this boat? These boats, 8 of them, actually.
Yeah, you know, I'd say about half the time there was another woman on board, one or two. And it's, for me, you know, I was there temporarily as a special visitor with a special purpose to document life. It's a lot different if that's your profession, and it can be a really challenging work environment for women. And it really depends. It's the same for women as it is for anybody on board. Your experience is so dependent on who is with you on any given rotation. So if you have 20 other folks on board who you like and get along with, it can be a great contract. If you have a bunch of folks who are total jerks and you don't get along, then it could be a bad contract. So it really just varies.
You talked with one woman at length, Shala. Tell us about her experience.
Shala was on Corsaro, that tanker with the special voyage in the Mediterranean. And yeah, she was about my age. She was 24 at the time, and she was a navigation officer. Great person, really strong. I really admired her. I mean, she had some experiences with crew members that hadn't been pleasant, and she stuck it out, and she was very, you know, set boundaries and, yeah.
Doing it well and making and supporting her family on that. So what's art got to do with this? How does this all become an art project at the Carrick Modern?
Well, I'm a documentary artist, and I'm trained in sound recording, so I did a lot of recording interviews and sounds. That was the point. You know, I wanted to tell the story of folks on board. I took a lot of video, too, and photo and writing. Blah, blah, blah. Well, I'll come back and I have 3 terabytes worth of digital cargo. I don't know. If you don't work with digital media, I don't even know how to tell you how many thousands of images that is and how many hours of sound, which is something I could sit with and be smothered by myself. But I would much rather turn over that material to other people to kind of take and see what they find in it. So I've kind of developed a collaborative storytelling laboratory, I call it. The first time I did it, it was at Oberlin College with 8 student artists who took the material and made an interactive exhibit performance. And I've done it again in Durham. And it's a really incredible experience to kind of have all these stories and people that I'd gotten to know and then to hand them off to a filmmaker, poets, visual artists, and see it become all of these things I never would have made.
Give us some examples. What would we see and hear at the Carrick?
Yeah, it's hard to even explain it with words. That's why you have to come and see. But it's a pretty it's a touch friendly installation. We've kind of tried to build the Carrick as it would be the inside of a ship, and so we have different spaces on the ship where you can interact with the navigation bridge. But then there's poetry hanging from the ceiling. There's a video projected into the closet. We've got some pirated movies from Hong Kong on the TV and like color blocks that are you move around. It's also the sound is a really important part of the installation. So you feel the humming vibration of being on a ship when you walk into the space. So I just think that it's so much more powerful to break off the screen into space and bring people into an environment to engage with it. Than to just send people a link. That's not what I want to do with my work. And so I'm trying to figure out new ways.
Well,
to
in a way, that's what the global economy is, right? These things come off boats and then we all use it. So you worked with how many artists in this area?
There are 9 other artists involved in this show. And I'm hoping to do it again. So if folks have an idea about the next place that the work might show or another group of artists or students who'd want to dig into the material, I'm all about it. I would like to hear ideas because it's not just my story to tell, and I really am interested in turning over this responsibility of storytelling to lots of other people.
It's a great project, Allison. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me here.
Allison Swaim, a radio documentarian. The show Hold Capacity, Trade Routes Reimagined, is up at the Carrick Modern Art Gallery in Durham until this Saturday. There's going to be a performance this Friday, August 9th at 8 o'clock. And that's our program for today. If you want to find out more, our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is directed by Alex Granados and produced by Sean Wen and Nicole Campbell. Adija Manley is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf, our news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.